It's time for a Big Blue Kickoff Live.
Nobody can ever tell you that you couldn't do it, because you did.
On Giants.com.
You know what I saw? New York Giant Prime.
And the Giants mobile app.
We'll punch you in the nose for 60 minutes with a relentless, competitive attitude.
Part of the Giants Podcast Network.
Let's go out there like a bunch of crazy dogs. Have some fun.
Welcome to Monday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live. Thanks so much for tuning in. Phone number 973-667-1960 as we move along here till 1 p.m. Eastern. He is Paul DiTino. I'm Lance Meadow. As a reminder, you can find the archive of this show and our entire podcast network brought to you by Investors Bank. It's on the Giants mobile app, podcast platforms everywhere, and at giants.com/podcast. So we'll continue to look ahead to the NFL draft about a week and a half away, thank goodness, so we don't have to beat the mock drafts like a dead horse for the next coming days. But we'll look ahead to two more teams today, Virginia Tech, which we already focused on, but we'll have some follow-ups regarding Caleb Farley as well as Christian Darrisaw, and then we'll turn our attention to the Kentucky Wildcats. So a lot to tackle over these next few minutes. And Paul, as I mentioned, closing in, inching closer to the NFL draft. So this is the time where the speculation heats up. We'll have some pro days coming up for the quarterbacks as the San Francisco 49ers decide who they want to select at number three. But we'll have some closure sooner rather than later, which is a big positive at this stage.
That's a big positive for all of us who don't like to deal with the smoke screens and the speculation, as you just alluded to. And Lance, I think one of the things that really got to me earlier today, I was looking at Albert Breer with his Monday morning quarterback column. And he seemed, well, I'd say better than 50-50 that there will be five quarterbacks taken in the top 10. And, you know, a lot of us have speculated about it. We've kind of joked about it. I think most of us are probably in the camp that it'll be three or four. But when I saw Breer today basically say, don't be shocked if it's five, that kind of got me thinking that maybe five is realistic. I've been on the side of caution saying it'll be four, but maybe five is really going to happen, and obviously that would make the Giants very pleased.
No doubt about it. I think if we do get to five, it probably would require a trade, a team to jump into the top 10, because once again, you look at the teams selecting between 4 and 10 ahead of the Giants. I think you can make a case for one. I don't know necessarily if I would make a case for two teams at this point taking quarterbacks. But listen, that's the uncertainty connected to the draft. I guess that makes it a little bit more exciting to anticipate the surprises that could come down the wire. But I would assume at this point that somebody would move up to get that number to five, in my mind.
Yes, I think that's got to be the case. You're not going to see five guys with the 10 teams that are currently slotted in those spots. It will have to be somebody moving up. And look, we all know, Lance, desperation causes teams to jump.
It could be the Falcons and Broncos too, boys. Not impossible.
Well, the Broncos was the one team that I was including as most likely to take a quarterback as it stands right now in terms of the draft order. They wouldn't even have to move.
No, they would not.
At the number nine spot. So we'll get more into that as we move along. But right now, let's turn our attention to the first of the two teams that we're going to preview today. And first up is Virginia Tech. And we are joined by former Virginia Tech defensive tackle who now serves as an analyst for the Virginia Tech Sports Network, none other than Luther Matty. Luther, you got Lance Meadow, Paul DiTino here on Giants.com, Big Blue Kickoff Live. Always good chatting with you. Appreciate the time again. How's everything on your end?
Everything's good, man. Always great talking to you guys. I really look forward to our conversations today.
Well, thanks so much, Luther. We're glad to have you with us. And, you know, one of the things that I guess since we last talked to you about a month or so ago, and we thought it was important to have you back on again, because we need to get a better understanding of what's happened to Darrisaw and Farley, the two guys who about a month or so ago, I think most people thought both guys had a good chance to be in the top 10 of the draft. Then Farley has this back surgery thing, and Darrisaw, for some reason, even though he has not played another game, seems to have fallen behind Slater in terms of being the number two offensive lineman on many boards. And look, you know these guys better than anybody does. So help us understand what you saw with those guys, if you could be more clear as to our first conversation. Tell me about these players. Let's go with Farley first. What do you understand about the back situation? And did you see anything during the course of the season that may have hinted that he had a problem?
Yeah, when it comes to Farley, I think the reason, to answer your question as to why he's kind of starting to slide a little bit, is definitely that back issue. I think teams are a little bit leery of that, and I totally understand. If you're going to be investing in a player and throwing tons of, you know, money and, you know, time into it, you want to make sure that they'll be able to come in and play right away. If you'll kind of draft them early up there at the top of the first round. So I think the back is definitely an issue. I don't think it's anything as far as, I don't know, game film or character. It's kind of right there, black and white. It's on video. That's not going to change. So it's nothing in regards to his film per se, but it's more so just teams getting more and more worried about that back issue is what it seems like to me so far.
From people around the program, Luther, what are you hearing about his rehab? And is it really all systems a go for camp, as he has said?
Yeah, quite honestly, I don't know too much about what he's doing as far as rehab, just because it's outside of the Virginia Tech facility. I'm not even sure who he's actually training with. So it's more so on their side. To the best of my knowledge, it's nothing that's going to hinder him really hard moving forward. It's just a matter of rehabbing and getting back into things. I don't think it's a major, major concern. But some teams, understandably so, are still kind of worried about it just a tad bit. But I'm not too sure how far along he is with his rehab or how's that going, or the intensiveness and things of that sort.
Final follow-up, Lance, before I let you get in here. Did at all during the course of the last time you've seen him practice or do whatever he was doing, did mm-hmm. you ever see anything that would have hinted that he had a back problem?
Not a back problem per se, but I think towards that his last year there was a couple of practices in a game or so where you could kind of see him being a little tender. I didn't know what it was. I thought it was something with his lower body. I think it might have been like a nick after a couple of plays. Nothing that I could have thought was his back, had a back issue. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's anything that somebody saw, or I didn't see it at least from the outside looking in. I didn't see any back issues. But there were times during the season where he did seem like he was a little bit tender on his legs, and he had something kind of going on with his, like, maybe ankles or knees. I'm just kind of throwing that out. I'm not sure what it was, but there were a few plays where he did have to kind of step out a little bit and go back in, step out a little bit, go back in. So, yeah, you can see that on film. It's pretty apparent that he had some sort of issue there his last season at Tech.
Interesting.
Well, and he even admitted that probably the second back procedure that he had should have been taken care of in the first procedure. So it's understandable that, to your point, Luther, you may have seen some back issue as he was playing. I think the positive is, according to what took place in Indianapolis a few weeks ago, he had the medical recheck. It seems as if NFL officials have given him the green light, and it looks like he could be back on the field before a training camp. I think the other thing, though, that we can't overlook, Luther, is hasn't played competitive football in quite some time. Back surgery aside, right, given the fact that he opted out. What do you think the rust factor at all could come into this equation, the fact that on top of the rehab, just has not lined up and gone up against competition, and where he is as a football player, at least at this point?
Yeah, I think that's a great, great, valid point. I mean, I'm obviously a Tech guy. I'm rooting for Caleb. I'm rooting for Darisaw, Diablo, all those guys, Herbert. I'm rooting for him to play 10 seasons plus in the NFL. But if I'm a GM and I'm somebody that's going to invest in a player, that definitely plays a factor in my eyes. Not even whether it's COVID or an injury or whatever it may be. If you're going to sit out a year, there's definitely going to be a rust factor, especially playing corner where you're left on an island so much and you have to recognize plays. You got to really get a good feel for things. It's not like you just line up at D line and just go straight forward and get to the quarterback. That's a bit different. You're out there like having to have certain types of eyes on these receivers, read patterns. Your feet work has to be straight. So, being that he hasn't been out there for so long in an actual football game, that's something that definitely concerns me on the outside looking in. And I think it's something you have to consider when you're going to draft these guys. They haven't played in so long. How will you be out there when you go play, you know, 11-11 in physical football, having to read these patterns and these great NFL quarterbacks making these big-time plays? Like, it's definitely something that you have to consider moving forward for sure.
Well, see, that leads me to my next question. And, Luther, this is boggling my mind because we heard so much about Darisaw before the season was even over that he might challenge Sewell to be the top offensive lineman in the draft. Now, he played and started all 9 games this past college season. Slater opted out. And yet, in almost every mock draft we've seen for the past month, Slater has passed him. Help me understand this.
Yeah, see, that's crazy. We literally just spoke about how not playing can kind of hurt your draft stock and things like that. But in this case, he has to play. He's still up there high in the draft. So it's kind of going back and forth and having different perspectives. But with Darrisaw, I always thought he wasn't he'll be a starter for sure. But I think there's just some plays where he just needs to kind of finish and, like, really bully guys. He has the technique. He has the footwork. He's insanely athletic, and he's able to cut off guys and does really good in pass protection and things of that sort. But I guess it's just the other guys. People are seeing them as plug and play immediately. I'm not too familiar with their tape or what kind of prospects they are. But from what I've been reading and hearing, it seems like those guys are a bit more ready, whereas Darrisaw might need just a little bit more time. Not saying he won't be a great starter, but those guys are like plug and play immediately. First day of camp, go ahead and put them in a game and let's go. So I think things like that kind of play a factor, whereas Darrisaw, he may have to wait just a tad bit to refine some of his tools.
Luther, when you say perhaps he has to work on finishing, because I've heard the same thing, people have questioned, does he have the killer instinct that it takes to be an anchor at left tackle on the NFL level? You watch some of his film, I mean, he'll push a guy upwards on the field like it's nothing, and you see the durability because he's been a starter for three seasons. So when you point to the finishing issue, is that more mental? Is it physical? How would you best describe that?
Yeah, great question. I think it's more mental. Physically, he has all the traits, but if you ever sit down and just kind of hang around Darrisaw, he's a real cool, even keel, mellow, just smooth guy. He's just one of those types of persons. So I think it's just sometimes on the football field he can get a little bit nonchalant. Not that he doesn't care. That's just kind of his – that's just who he is as a person. Whereas, you know, when he plays football and he steps on that grass, you got to kind of flip the switch, which he does, don't get me wrong. But he just needs to be a little bit more consistent, just being like a real dog out there and just finishing guys. He definitely is strong enough. He has the long arms. He has the traits, the quickness, you know, that kind of plays a factor into finishing. He just needs to have that mindset that every single play, I want to punish this guy and reestablish that line of scrimmage. So I don't think it's more his physical tools. It's more so just mentally, just the way he is. He's a real cool, calm, mellow guy. Just need to be able to flip that switch every single play and just dominate these guys right in front of him.
Final question from me, Luther, in terms of Darrisaw. A lot of what we've heard about Slater in the last month as he has moved up on these boards is that not is he just only a plug-and-play guy, but he's a plug-and-play guy who can play tackle but is going to be a sensational guard. And that extra versatility also adds value to a player when he's coming out. How do you feel about Darrisaw being a guard? And would he have that potential to be a dominant guard so that maybe people are missing that and they should be considering that when they value him?
Yeah, that's a great question, yeah. So if you can obviously play multiple positions, that obviously adds a whole lot to your draft stock. But in regards to Darrisaw, I don't know. I don't really see him going inside. Just the way his body's built, he's kind of, you know, he's not lanky, but he's tall. He has, you know, long arms, long legs. His hips are pretty high. And he even sometimes plays kind of high in his stance and his kick step going back on pass protection. And we just spoke about having to be a guy that dominates and finishes plays. When he played guard, you must definitely – when he go more inside like guards and the centers, you most definitely have to have that mindset where you have to literally crush guys. Like, those are big 300-plus pound defensive nose tackles and three techniques in there. So you have to rely on just being dominant and just punching guys in their chest. And I don't think Darrisaw, that's not really his forte, quite honestly. I think he could probably do it if he was asked to, but I don't see him being a great player at guard. I'd rather see him play tackle and just do his thing out there.
Luther Matty. Former Virginia Tech defensive tackle, now serves as an analyst for the Virginia Tech Sports Network. Luther, greatly appreciate the time and the insight. Look forward to talking to you down the road. Stay safe.
Be well.
All right, guys. Talk to you later.
You as well. So that is Luther Matty giving us an update on Caleb Farley and Christian Darrisaw. Darrisaw, it's not a question about injury. Farley, it's more of the back and whether or not that will hold up. If he does fall, as many do project, somebody could very well get a steal late in the first round, early second round, because if the projections show that he'll be ready to go before training camp starts, right around late July, because they figure it's about a four-month rehab and he had surgery in L.A. late March, you know, that could perhaps give a team, especially a team that made the playoffs last year, Paul, an opportunity to add even more depth and more options in their secondary here.
Well, there's no doubt about that, but it's also going to probably be a team that does not need to get him on the field in week one. Because you got to figure, given the fact that he hasn't had much action lately, and you just heard Luther talk about the rust factor, well, consider now he's rehabbing off of the back situation. Lord only knows by the time they get to training camp, whenever that is, how much time is it really going to get or take for him to get the oil going? You know, when he's finally going to be able to really do what he needs to do to start working on his craft. Might it be a whole season? Might it be half a season? If you need him to step onto the field in week one, I don't know, Lance. It seems like you might be asking for trouble.
Well, you should certainly expect it to be trouble if that's the guy you're relying on to do the heavy lifting in your secondary. I wouldn't disagree with you there, but if you already have 2 to 3 guys that you're relying on and you can move him along slowly and maybe you don't have to give him heavy snaps in the first few weeks, and then by the time week 5 rolls along, that could be a good position to draft Caleb Farley. So I think that would be a big positive depending on how things play out. So we're going to be turning our attention to Kentucky, as Nick Roush will be joining us momentarily as we'll break down the Kentucky Wildcats and get a layout of the land in terms of what that group is going to do. But before we do that, let's try to squeeze in a caller here. We got Peter in the Florida Keys. What's happening, Peter? Okay, I guess Peter is a man of very few words.
Still screening him. He's there now.
Oh, okay. All right, Peter. Welcome aboard to Big Blue Kickoff Live. What do you got for us?
Hey, guys. How you doing today?
Hi.
Doing all right. What's on your mind?
Good. A couple quick things. I have a Daniel Jones question for you, and also a tackle guard question for you as well. With respect to the draft with the tackle guard, I caught the last part of that conversation that you guys had with that media person or the beat writer that you had. Is it more of a physical trait or more of a mentality for when people can project tackles that can push inside the guard?
Both.
That's both?
It's both. It's both. You have to have the frame and the power to be able to play on the interior line that you don't necessarily have to have a tackle where it's a lot more technique-oriented. And then on top of that, as he alluded to, Luther Maddie from Virginia Tech was alluding to, it's also a mentality because of the physical nature and the bullying kind of nature that you have on the interior of the line. You've got to have the mentality to use that force.
Gotcha. Okay, thanks for clearing
that up. Keep in mind, when you're a tackle, so you got to worry about the edge. You don't have somebody next to you on your left or your right, depending on what side. Whereas with respect to a guard, you're working with not nearly as much space and territory. So I think the ideology, the mental makeup is a little bit different in terms of your assignment. And then on top of that, you have to take into consideration, do they have long arms? Do they have the body that they can handle either the tight space or the extra space? So both factors certainly play a role.
Gotcha. Okay. And then another quick question about Daniel Jones. You guys don't have to go into detail. I know we actually have a lot of time to talk about it after the draft. You know, obviously he's going into his third year. And a lot of people, it's up in the air if he truly is our franchise quarterback for the future. What one piece of the puzzle are you looking for this year to solidify in your heads that he is indeed our franchise quarterback? Unless you think so already. And I'll take that off the air.
All right, Peter. Appreciate the phone call. Thanks so much for weighing in. Well, I mean, I think cleaning up the turnovers is a big part of that. You want to see that number dip. There were times this season where it did dip, but it came in stretches as opposed to consistency across the board. And you want to see him be able to capitalize and take advantage of some of the new talent that was brought onto this roster. Consistency and getting drives to finish with touchdowns, I think, is a big part of him taking the next step forward here this season.
You know, you can have all the weapons in the world, but if they're not in sync with the quarterback and the quarterback doesn't make them look better, then they can't make him look better. So I'm really looking forward to see how he blends with Kenny Golladay. I'm looking forward to seeing if Slayton can take another step up and he and Jones can have the kind of success that they had when Slayton was a rookie.
That's the name of the game. You want to see everybody be on the same page, especially when you're talking about new talent. And you want to see the decision-making of the quarterback move along and progress. So, you know, those are, I think, are the key elements when you talk about whether or not a quarterback is the guy or is capable of being a consistent force under center. But keep in mind, Daniel Jones is in a similar position to some other young quarterbacks in the NFL, where they've had a revolving door at talent around them. They've had a revolving door of coordinators and play callers around them. So, you know, stability around the quarterback, the environment, is just as important as the skill set and what the quarterback brings to the table. I don't think we can lose track of that, Paul. I think we, once again, we tend to focus on the quarterback being the savior, but you can't dismiss, well, what have you put around the quarterback to allow him to flourish as well?
I'd like to add one more thing, if I may, Lance, and that would be durability. I mean, I'm not trying to be a wise guy, but we know that, you know, Eli Manning, he was going to play, and he was going to take every snap. It took five fire trucks, you know, and five Clydesdale horses and five elephants to try to yank him from the lineup. You know, Daniel Jones, unfortunately, because of injury concerns, has missed at least a game in each of his first two seasons. So I do think, you know, you don't want that to become a habit where all of a sudden we start talking about, well, is Daniel Jones going to be healthy enough to be the franchise quarterback?
I think that's something that I would obviously take into consideration. I don't know if that would be the overwhelming factor that I would be worried about to determine whether or not a quarterback is the guy. I mean, you brought up Eli Manning. Remember, Eli Manning was a very rare player in terms of durability.
We're spoiled. Let's face it, we're spoiled.
Yeah.
Eli was a machine.
You figure when you bring in a quarterback, he's bound to miss games just with the way that the NFL has played out. I mean, even if you look at a guy like Drew Brees, who has missed games over the course of the latter part of his career before he retired, it's bound to happen. When you have somebody that goes over a decade without missing a start due to injury, such as an Eli Manning and a Phillip Rivers, there's a reason why there's only about two to three guys in that category. Hell, even Tom Brady missed a season, Paul, too, with the torn ACL, the knee injury. And, of course, he missed games because of suspension. That had nothing to do with injury. But as great as Brady is and as much as he's playing into the deep portion of his career, you still need to anticipate that he's going to miss games. So I don't know if I'm necessarily getting caught up in Daniel Jones. You know, if he misses two games, he's definitely not the guy.
Oh, no, 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 no,
no,
no. I
want to see more of the decision-making and the talent around him come together.
I'm not suggesting that if he misses a game or two, he is not capable of being the franchise quarterback. I'm simply saying it's not a good habit to get into when all of a sudden you're dinged and you got bumps and you got bruises that force you to start missing games year after year after year. Now, of course, Ben Roethlisberger has been in that boat. I mean, when you look at his career, it's what, less than half of the years that he's played in the league that he was able to play a full season. So it would not preclude him from being a franchise guy, but you certainly feel a lot more comfortable when your franchise guy can be counted on to play every game.
Well, you want to be reliable. You want to know that that's the player that is going to be out there game in and game out. So you don't have to worry about, you know, somebody else all of a sudden coming to the forefront and then changing the complete dynamics of your offense. So I would absolutely agree with that. I don't think there's any doubt about that with respect to what's happening for any team with their quarterback. All right, let's head back to the phone lines here. John is in Maine, and he joins us.
Hello, Lance. Hello, Paul.
Hi.
Hey, I wanted to make a point. I keep hearing, not from you necessarily, but from national guys, that Daniel Jones causes a lot of turnovers. But I looked at every game. I looked at the box scores. I think it's on Pro Football Network. And the main point is in the last six games, he's only caused one turnover with a fumble. There was an interception that bounced off of Ingram and another fumble that bounced off of Gallman.
Correct.
Yeah, so in the last six games, he's responsible for one turnover, and I think that's excellent.
Oh, you're 100% correct. See, this is the narrative of the critics, the naysayers, the people who like to shoot darts. They can't help themselves. Well, you know, you think these people can't help themselves. If they have it out for a guy, they will refuse to recognize his improvement. And that's really a shame, but people like to have blinders. And, you know, if you look at Daniel Jones this past season, John Schmelk, who's producing for us today, he looked at it. I know I spent hours upon hours looking at every single one of Jones's turnovers, okay? And the fact remains, he was tremendously advanced in terms of the turnover problem over his rookie season. Not even close. And the only metric that you could look at in terms of him going backwards, and the only one, was touchdown passes. In every other way, shape, and form, Daniel Jones was an improved quarterback during his second NFL season. That's a fact, no matter what anybody else tells you, because they obviously didn't study the film.
Well, you know, I think some of the reason why he doesn't have as many passing touchdowns, they had, I think, a chance for more running touchdowns, and they tried to do that on that end.
That's certainly part of it.
I also, what I do is I kind of compare him to Phil Sims. And I think he's kind of similar in his career so far. I didn't look at Sims' numbers, but Sims was not a bad quarterback at all at first, but he wasn't called one of the best or anything like that. And I think I really like Jones. I think he's a very accurate passer. And anyway, I like Jones. I don't think he's got a turnover problem. And if we can get him a guard, I like his chances this year. And well, I don't think it's a make it or break it year. That's what people want headlines, I think. If he does decent and so on, I think he'll be fine.
Thank you, John.
Appreciate the phone call.
You're welcome, guys. Good show. Take care.
All right. Thanks so much for weighing in. Every turnover has its own story. Remember, there was the season Eli Manning threw a lot of interceptions, and at least five or six of them were deflections off of wide receivers' hands. So context is important. I still think it's fair, though, to say that Daniel Jones, if you were to ask him, you want to keep the turnovers down in general, okay? You know, even if you remove a few of those turnovers that the caller referenced, the volume is going to hurt the team no matter who's responsible for the turnover. So if you want to say in general, if you don't want to sign it to Daniel Jones, you want to say the Giants need to keep the turnovers down, that's fine. If we want to classify it that way, I think, though, the last 2 years, it's fair to say the team overall needs to cut down on the turnovers to maximize the number of possessions that they have.
I don't think the number is out of whack right now. In fact, if you look at his percentage, interceptions per attempt, it did go down last year compared to his rookie season, which indicates improvement. I think it's in the ballpark of being functional. You always want your turnovers to be down. You'd love to have one of those seasons where, like, Nick Foles had two picks in a whole year. Those are really far and few between. They're rare. That's being unrealistic. It's asking too much of a guy to say go into this season and only throw two picks. I mean, that's just insanity. If you can keep them down to a touchdown percentage of 2.5% or less, teams can win with that.
All right, let's turn our attention back to the NFL draft. We mentioned that we were going to preview another school, and Kentucky is now up, as Nick Roush, who covers Kentucky football for Kentucky Sports Radio, joins us here on Big Blue Kickoff Live. Nick, you got Lance Middle, Paul DeTino. Appreciate the time today. How's everything on your end?
Hey, I'm doing great. Appreciate y'all having me on to talk some draft. It feels like we're slowly getting there, but we're certainly excited. Especially down here in Lexington with a handful of guys who will probably be taken off the board.
Absolutely. Well, Kentucky does have substance. And let's start with probably the first guy that will go off the board, and that's linebacker Jamin Davis, who was just a one-year starter, but in that 1 year proved to be a disruptive player, also seemed to be a bit of a ball hawk as well. Where do you see his best fit, Nick, on the NFL level, considering even though he's been productive, it is still a relatively small sample size?
It is a small sample size. The UK coaches likened him to a slow cooker, and he wasn't even expected to be the man for UK's defense last year. Chris Oates was a four-star recruit who was well on his way to an all-SEC season whenever he had an untimely stroke in the offseason that forced Davis into play. And this time a year ago, we were just wondering if Davis could be the guy to fill the middle for UK. But in that time, he really shined. He came on strong at the end of his sophomore season, had a great month of November, and then last year was phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And the thing that really sets Davis apart is his ability, his just overall athleticism, particularly in the past. UK was able to, they were able to be a little bit more lenient with their calls because they knew that Davis could cover whoever whenever they needed it. And I know his position coach mentioned at least at one point one of the most impressive plays he saw. He didn't make a tackle. He didn't do anything, but he did cover Kyle Pitts in the open field. That's a mismatch almost any time when you get Kyle Pitts on the middle linebacker. But Davis was able to run with him, and, you know, I think it resulted in an incomplete pass, but no harm, no foul. Davis is just a crazy athlete who does have a ton of upside. I know getting him acclimated with a new defense might be difficult at first, but, man, he really is a special talent athletically. His, like every pro day this year, the numbers were a bit obscene, but I can believe a lot of Davis's. He is a freak athlete in every sense of the word.
Well, anytime somebody talks about a player with those kinds of skills, the first question that comes to mind is, okay, where does he fit in a pro-style defense, and where are you going to utilize him? Because too many guys get misused, and then they don't reach their full potential, or they don't wind up paying off at the relative value or position that they were taken in. So let me ask you to project him into an NFL defense. I like him as a weak side linebacker. Where would you put him?
See, and I think he does have the athleticism to do that, but he also has the size to play Mike. I know the NFL offenses are getting much more spread out now, so I think that is a valuable tool. And for a lot of teams, I think it's going to come down to need. How much depth do you have at that linebacker spot? But I think he can play either the Mike or the Will. Just kind of really depending on need. I know most of the mock drafts have him going 26 to the Cleveland Browns, kind of as the second inside guy taken behind Micah Parsons. And I think a lot of the reason of it is not just the athleticism, but also the upside, because like you all said, he's only had 1 year. Some might see that as just a limited body of work. But as you said, he has a nose for the football. He had an 85-yard pick six against Tennessee. He helped a shutout against Mike Leach's air raid offense. It was the first time he's ever been shut out offensively by picking off a pass in the end zone right before half. So I think most teams, it's going to come down to how badly do they want him, do they need him at that Mike spot. But as a Will, just based on his pass coverage ability, is probably where he'll end up going.
Nick, I want to stay on the defensive side of the ball with respect to cornerback Kelvin Joseph, and he clearly has more playing time than Jamin Davis, as we were just talking about. But I think the big concern about him, before we maybe get into the X's and O's, is maybe the character issue. Because from what I've heard, he sort of had one foot out the door late in the season, and the coaching staff told him, hey, you might as well just opt out if you're not that interested in playing. So how concerning is that, the maturity issue, as he tries to now make the jump to the NFL?
Well, those are all fair criticisms. You know, he goes by Boss Man Fat. That's his name when he's making music. He's big friends with Boozy down in Baton Rouge, and you know he's got quite a few tracks on the Spotify if you want to check them out. But I know that there were a lot of people weren't happy because he had one game to go. He had one game to go. He could have opted out of the ball and have been fine, but instead he opts out with one game left. But considering all that, he is just a bona fide talent. I know at that position, you have to have confidence that even if you do get beat, you've got to go out there the next play and kill it. In the opener, Seth Williams, I know we use the phrase, put him on a poster all the time for basketball, but Seth Williams just mossed all over that man in the end zone, and there's a great photograph of it. And it's brutal. It could end somebody's career, but instead he came back and he had four interceptions. And 2 weeks later, he had one against Mississippi State. He's really, really good in the field. He's physical. But – He did only have the 1 year as a full-time guy at UK. He played a little bit at LSU. He has all the raw physical tools. It's about being consistent. I know the Titans are kind of looking for a cornerback, but as one of my friends who's a Titans fan said, you know, there's already one LSU guy there. We don't need another one to kind of, you know, maybe rub him the wrong way. So if he gets in the right spot and he can get through that first year or two, I really do think he can hang around for a while, but a lot of it is going to be about maturing and learning how to do the daily in and out of being a professional football player.
There's no doubt about his ability to be sticky. My question would be, do you also think he's got slot ability?
You know, he's not like too many corners. I mean, Kentucky has put some guys in the league over the years, but not that kind of elite kind of athlete. So they never really worked him there. But I do think he does have the speed to catch up in the slot. Now, whether he's able to come up and run support, I don't know. He wasn't asked to do that a whole lot. But I think Joseph, you kind of nailed it off the top. I mean, a lot of his issues aren't so much as skill-wise and athletic-wise. It's more of a one-two thing, and how confident are coaches that they can make sure that he stays on the right path.
One other follow-up with respect to Kelvin Joseph, and, you know, we talked about how he could be a sticky defender, opportunistic with the five passes defense, the four interceptions. The other statistic, though, Nick, that was notable was the fact that he gave up some big plays. And when he did give up big completions, they averaged nearly 17 yards per completion, which certainly jumps off the page, as well as three touchdowns. How much does he walk that fine line, as effective as he is as a defender, is also giving up a number of big plays?
In a lot of those big plays, I alluded to the Williams one earlier. Whenever you all, whenever Kyle Pitts' name is called, there's going to be a video of Pitts just running away from Joseph for like a 60-yard touchdown or something like that. Some of it is, I don't know if it's just going up against the other team's best receiver, or if it is I'm beat kind of mentality, because a lot of the guys that he was tasked to guard are going to be coming off at the top of the board. So that's the gamble that you play with him, and that's why he's probably going to be a day two, maybe even a day three pick in the, excuse me, not day three, but a second or third rounder in the NFL draft.
Now, there's a guy on defense that really intrigues me, Quentin Bohanna, your defensive tackle over there. They measured him at 6'4", 327. He's one of those run stuffers, one of those pluggers, one of those old-time, old-school guys. He's not going to get much on the quarterback, but my goodness, he can really stuff things on the inside against the run. How do you see him coming into the NFL?
Well, as much as Jamin is built for this NFL, Bohanna, I mean, he would have been way aboard if this was, 10 years ago or so, because he is kind of that traditional nose that's good at plugging up holes. He's a two-gapper, and he's really explosive for that size, too. And I don't think you give noses credit enough for that, because they're mostly tasked just to take up space. But for a man his size, he does move well, and he also had just some unfortunate kind of nagging injuries throughout his time at UK. Now, going back to his sophomore year, I believe he was a true sophomore, too. I don't even think he was a redshirt. As soon as he started playing well, he gets an ankle injury, and then he's kind of ineffective for the next few weeks. So there's been some limitations as far as that goes. But, man, in whatever 3-4 team needs a nose, he can be that guy, and he can be that for a long time.
I want to continue to stay on the defensive side of the ball, specifically guys that can play in the trenches. And maybe this is not somebody that is going to be drafted high, but it's hard to overlook his production, Nick, and that's edge rusher Jamar Watson. You look at his tackles for loss, you look at his sacks, you look at his durability, and then I guess similar to what we were talking about with Jamin Davis, where's his fit on the NFL level? I've even heard comparisons, not to say he's Josh Allen. I don't want to go that far, Nick, but question right. Similar to Josh Allen was, well, is he a tweener? Is he a linebacker? Is he a guy you're going to play at the line of scrimmage? So where do you see Watson at all filling in or fitting in on the NFL level?
The thing with Boogie, he had a great, I believe it was his junior year, but he was the yin to Allen's yang. So whenever teams focus too much attention on Josh, he was able to kind of clean up the mess. But I think his versatility is his strength, because he was called upon early on in his career. I believe he was a redshirt freshman, where they had some injuries at inside linebacker, and then it was a goal line stand. So third down, backer goes up, makes a tackle on the sideline, hurts his shoulder. They've got to bring in Boogie, who had played edge the entire year. That week, they said they taught him Mike. They taught him how to play Mike. And on that fourth and goal, he's the guy putting his nose in and make the play. His versatility is really his strength. And this year, when he didn't have the year he wanted to as far as sack numbers, I think it kind of showed us that he's probably best standing up. He made one of the best plays of the year in that Mississippi State game. I go back to it. They threw about 17 interceptions that game. But he quite literally ripped the ball out of the wide receiver's hands at the goal line for an interception. And it was just reading his cues. He didn't read the ball or anything. It was kind of blind coming over his shoulder, but he made the right play at the right time. I think there is going to be he may not get drafted, but I do think that somebody is going to get a steal in free agency where he can play a little bit of both on the as a stand-up outside linebacker and then do a lot for special teams because he's a gifted athlete.
One more guy that I'd like to ask you about, and that's Landon Young, the left tackle who, look, after missing 1 year with the knee injury, he's been at Kentucky, I think, for now 6 years total, which is the max you can have as an NCAA player, including the red shirt. So he's certainly older and more experienced. He's started a whole bunch of games. I don't know that he's athletic enough necessarily to play in the league, but certainly you got to love his determination and his grit and his size at 6'6". I mean, somebody may take a shot at him as a priority free agent and hope that they can develop something.
Well, and the thing about Landon, too, is he was called on and thrown in the fire immediately. As a true freshman, Kentucky starting left tackle blew his knee out at Florida. And going down and getting your number called as a true freshman play at the Swamp, it ain't easy. But I think he had one mix-up and pass pro. But aside from that, played well, has played a ton of football. And really, I mentioned the pass pro just because that's his only – that and maybe his arm length is his only real concern because he didn't have a lot of reps. You know, Kentucky had that one season where every quarterback known to man got hurt and they had to play Lynn Bowden, and it was just, we're going to run the ball, run the ball, run the ball. He is an effective mauler who has shown time and time again that he can run block at the elite level. It's just whether or not is he good enough in his pass sets, which at his pro day or right before it, he mentioned that some teams might have talked to him about guard. I could see that happening because he's so effective on the interior, or just so effective at blocking downhill. But as for the athleticism concerns, he really did an exceptional job just since the season ended at trimming down and getting those numbers right for his pro day. So I know I can kind of sound like a homer at times, but I think he is one that, you're right, somebody's going to get a steal out of them because – There is still to work with. I think you can get a little bit better at press pro with time. He just didn't get the reps at Kentucky that he needed.
Well, the one thing is you can't teach his frame. Physically, he's got a frame where he's going to be able to potentially put on some strength and muscle, which could certainly help his game.
No, you're 100% correct. Because he's just a big man. You know, he's like country strong. During the offseason, his dad put him to work at the farm. He was lifting hay bales as like form of exercise. They still throw on weight racks. He is your old school country strong, and I really hope that he gets his shot at the next level because he's been a joy to have in Lexington the last 4, 5, 6 years.
Nick, speaking of frame, before we let you go, they have another offensive lineman, but we don't necessarily have questions about him because he pretty much has just been a center over the course of his career, and that's Drake Jackson. And the reason I bring up his frame, it seems as if he lost about 20 pounds entering this season because he wanted to improve his speed and his stamina. Two-part question here. Number one, does he have the versatility in your mind to play guard if a team wanted to move him? And number two, how much more than just durability stands out with respect to his game?
Well, his greatest strength was really being kind of the de facto coach for the group, for the lack of a better term. It's been well documented in places. I know College Game Day did an excellent profile, but the offensive line coach, John Schwarman, he lost his long battle with cancer this year. And for a lot of it, Drake had to be the guy who basically acted as Schwarman's he became the coach of the offensive line. He knows the game really well. He did all of the calls at the line of scrimmage. That they didn't put that on the quarterback. They put it on Drake because he knew where to go. He's really intelligent. He's widely regarded as the best center in UK history. Even though Dermoni Dawson went to UK, he played guard.
That says a lot. Oh boy.
Yeah, but Dermoni did play guard at UK, so there is that little, you put that little caveat in there. But as far as versatility, I don't know, but Drake is a really smart, intelligent football player who whenever he was always at his best when he had to go up against the best. Jeffrey Simmons was at Mississippi State. I wouldn't say they're a thorn in UK side, but that's a pretty big cross-divisional rivalry. And Drake typically had his way with him. He always did well against the best. I know he was looking forward to going up against McNeil from NC State in that Gator Bowl, but McNeil kind of opted out of that game. He's got a little bit of injury. But I know Drake really was hungry to put that tape out there. He then did well in the Senior Bowl, and then he even had like an AC joint sprain or something like that happened during the game. He's like, no, I'm not coming out. I'm playing through this because I want to put this out there. He's a tough, smart dude. So it's one of those where I hope that his height, he's only about 6 foot. I think he's the shortest of all the center prospects. The frame's always going to hurt him, but I think he can make up for it with his toughness and his football IQ.
He is Nick Roush, who covers Kentucky football for Kentucky Sports Radio. Nick, greatly appreciate the time and the insight. Look forward to talking down the road. Thanks again.
Thank you, Nick. Great stuff.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It feels kind of weird to talk about these guys after they're gone, but I've enjoyed every minute of it. have a happy NFL draft here in about 9 days.
Yes, we are certainly looking forward to that. Thanks again, Nick. Greatly appreciated as we are counting down the days and monitoring the clock as we inch closer to the NFL draft. And there is some depth in this Kentucky class, as we just heard from Nick. I think probably the best way I would describe this Kentucky group, Paul, is intrigue, because you sort of like what you see with some of these guys. You just have questions about where they're going to fit in. And it's not just one player. It's at least 4 to 5 players that we discuss. It's just where are you going to put them when they make the NFL?
Well, I think in their case, it's probably more about guys who will make the 53s as opposed to how many guys are going to immediately be starters. I mean, maybe there's one or two, but I think what you'll see are a bunch of guys who may have roles on a team, may start out as special teams guys, then maybe become backups. And who knows? Maybe this guy's the limit for some of these guys. Who, you know, you just can't figure that out right now. But I do agree with you. It's an intriguing class because they do have a lot of guys who could potentially have make it grades.
Well, and as we were talking about with respect to a player like Jamar Watson, who maybe he doesn't get drafted and maybe he becomes a priority free agent, the Giants have had some success with undrafted players who they've brought in and have made the 53-man roster. So you never know. You could be pleasantly surprised if you do your homework and somebody all of a sudden goes through 7 rounds, doesn't get selected, you bring them into camp, and then they wow you. Now, remember, the biggest challenge last year, Paul, that we talked about was if you don't have much of an offseason and they didn't get on the field until training camp, it puts those players at a disadvantage. And I think that played out based on who ultimately made the 53-man roster. Do things drastically change this year? Well, based on the movement we've seen across the board, there's not going to be much of a voluntary session during OTAs. It's probably just going to be maybe a mandatory minicamp, if at all. And then most of the heavy lifting, of course, is going to be done again at training camp. So I would still say the rookies, the undrafted free agents, it's going to be quite an uphill battle for them to make rosters once again this year.
Well, one of the things that will help those types of guys are the experiences that they had in college. A guy who maybe was a 3-year starter or played the better part of his entire 4-year career. Those snaps that he took at the NCAA level, every one of them is going to be very key as he tries to advance to the next level in the NFL. You know, you're talking about these 1 or 2 year starters. Any of those priority free agents, you know they've got a taller hill to climb, Lance. That's just a fact. It's not their fault, but it's just a fact. The guys who got more snaps at the bigger time programs will have a little bit more of an edge.
And then when you consider the players that opted out, that's even more of a question mark, because if they don't have much of an NFL offseason this year in terms of workouts, and I'm talking about organized workouts, players are going to work out themselves, okay?
Yes.
Let's not be naive. Let's not overlook that. It's not as if the players are just sitting on their couches eating bags of Doritos, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be working out. And some players, by the way, would argue that's more advantageous to them to be in their own setting, an intimate setting with their personal trainers or smaller group. So time will tell with respect to that, but I'm referring to, we were talking about Caleb Farley, for example, earlier in the program. Farley, it's not a matter of how the offseason program goes. He's recovering from back surgery, but then on top of that, he wasn't in a competitive environment. You have to go back to 2019. So those are the players that I think they would be able to benefit from some type of a structured offseason under the guidance of a team, given the fact that you want to monitor them and get them back on the path to build themselves up to actually taking part in competitive games.
Mm-hmm. No, look, a big part of all of this is going to be what the medical staffs say about any of those guys, because not only do you have guys who may have been coming off of injury or just because they decided to opt out because of COVID, maybe their bodies aren't used to getting hit because they haven't been punished,
sure,
you know, for a year and a half. And so now you go to training camp and guys are a little bit sore. Guys are pulling little soft tissue injuries. And now the medical staff has to step in and say, oh, coach, hold on a second. You know, no, we got to pull it back on this guy. And so no matter how much the coach may want to advance the player or the player wants to advance himself, circumstances may not let him. And it's unfortunate, but those guys are going to get caught behind the eight ball.
973-667-1960. That's the telephone number. A reminder, limited Giants season tickets are on sale now for the 2021 season. In addition to ticket savings, membership benefits include access to exclusive events, experiences, pre-sales, and more. You can lock in your seat starting at just $100. Call 888-NYG-1925, or you can visit giants.com/tickets for more information. Also, don't miss out on your chance to experience a premier hospitality experience watching Giants games and world-class concerts in 2021 as a Giants suite partner. Limited full-season locations are available, or you can place a deposit for individual games. You can call also 888-NYG-1925 or visit giants.com/suites for more information. And Giants fans get a New York Giants checking account from Investors Bank with a Giants-branded debit card. Security features and discounts at the Giants online shop. You can earn up to $250 when you open an account at investorsbank.com/Giants, member FDIC. As we move forward here on Big Blue Kickoff Live, one of the other things that we were talking about earlier in the program that I want to revisit, a caller had raised the question about Daniel Jones and what you want to see out of him this season, and we were talking about the turnovers and how context is important. So I'm looking at the numbers. The Giants had 22 turnovers as a team. They finished even in turnover differential. That was tied for 17th in the NFL because they also had 22 takeaways. So when I look at the number 22, I would say that's overall on the high side. When you look at the NFL numbers, they had 11 interceptions and 11 fumble recoveries in terms of the takeaway breakdown. But the turnovers were a mix of fumbles, interceptions, you name it. 22, when you just look at the breakdown, Paul, they had at least two turnovers in 7 of their games. So that's nearly half of their games. They had multiple turnovers. To me, it's irrelevant whether it was on Daniel Jones or not. The bottom line is that's a relatively high volume that you want to cut down, because when you lose games and you go back and you watch the Giants losing a lot of close games, sometimes that extra possession is the difference between tacking on an extra field goal, having an additional red zone opportunity, and that's how all of a sudden you fall out of the mix for a playoff spot.
Well, that is a team stat, though. The question from the caller earlier, or I guess the comment that we were trying to sort through, was about Daniel Jones's turnovers. I don't think his numbers, turnover-wise, were out of whack this past season. They were better than they were as a rookie, and I think they were much more in line of what you can swallow as an NFL coach. But as a team, I don't think there's any doubt you would like to see the Giants get some of those numbers down some. But again, regarding Jones, I don't have a problem with his percentage of turnovers. And in fact, as we look at the latter half of the season, and the caller made reference to it, going into the final game against Dallas, did you know Daniel Jones had the longest active streak of passes without an interception until Ingram batted that ball up in the air and it got picked? So, I mean, let's just talk about the facts. The kid's gotten better. That's just a fact.
Well, that's why I think it's a tale of two halves if you look back at Daniel Jones's 2020 season, because he had at least one turnover in each of the first eight games, and then in the second half of the season, because that's perfect, it's even at eight apiece, you look at him having one fumble against the Cardinals in week 14, and then the fumble against the Cowboys. So he only had two turnovers that were charged to him in the final eight games, versus he had at least one in each of the first eight. Now, he did miss a few games due to injury, in fairness, so he didn't necessarily play all of those eight games. Context is important, but there's no doubt about it. The numbers, the decision-making improved in the second half of the season. Now you want to see that carry over into the start of 2021. I think that's the goal when you look at the totals for at least specifically Daniel Jones last season.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that the Giants are hoping is that the addition of Saquon Barkley into the backfield, you know, coming back off of the injury, will help the Giants be able to run the ball more effectively, which therefore takes a lot of pressure off of the passing game. And then when they do have to throw it, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. We're talking about Kenny Golladay being one of your best contested catch receivers in the National Football League. I mean, that in itself should also help a little bit too.
The more talent you put around the quarterback, the more playmakers, to your point. You would hope that when the quarterback, right, throws it up there and he expects his guys to make a play, that they'll come through. Because that's another way that you cut down on turnovers. Meaning, maybe it's a bad throw. Maybe it's not an ideal throw. But somebody else down the field is going to maybe make up for it. You know, that to me is what made Calvin Jones unique. Calvin Johnson, excuse me. Julio Jones, I would put in that category. Those are playmakers that, aside from their just pure makeup and their build, which jumps out to you, is that quarterbacks have faith that if they're double teamed or maybe they have a tough one-on-one assignment, I like my chances of throwing the ball up there and my guy winning that battle. That's another way that you turn 50-50 balls much more in favor of yourself.
Lance, there's a reason why for years and years I have been screaming probably 10 times louder than anybody on this show about getting a skyscraping wide receiver. It's all part of it. You know, again, the game is a spider web, and one thing affects another. And one of the ways that you can help your quarterback become a winner and become a big play guy is to have guys who are in your receiving core who can fight for the ball and make plays for him. And a skyscraper with that large radius and that big box that you could just throw the ball into, we saw it with Plaxico Burress. Boy, what a difference he made for Eli Manning. It was just monumental. Look, you guys know how I feel about Eli. I believe he's a first ballot Hall of Famer, and I'm not backing off of that in any way, shape, or form. But if Plaxico Burress doesn't get here, boy, I'm not sure that Eli's career takes the jump that it takes when they wind up going to the Super Bowl in 07. Actually, Burris got here a couple of years earlier, but the bottom line is he helped Eli become a top six quarterback in the NFL because of his presence.
Well, because when they went to him in the red zone, more often than not, he come through with a play. And
didn't
he was
even
also
have to
big.
Be the red zone. Didn't even have to be. They'd be
well,
on the
but specifically,
30-yard
that's
line.
What he, stood out, though, I would know, argue.
Well, for me, I would disagree with that. I think he stood out much more between the 30s and the 40s because when they were anywhere near the 30 or 35 of their own, you knew that Plaxico could go down and make a 25 or 30-yard play. And a lot of times he would catch a ball there, out-wrestle the DB, leave him in the dust, and then yards after the catch, he was gone. To be perfectly frank with you, Lance, Plaxico Burress was not as much of a red zone threat as he was a 50-50 threat who would then get yak yardage. That's where he really made his money for Eli.
Well, I think also, though, if you look at his production against the Philadelphia Eagles, there was a lot of red zone production against Philadelphia.
Well, so he was a thorn in the Eagles' side for sure. That was a little bit of a different scenario, but he also had a lot of yaks against them, too. A lot of them.
I look at him as a player that came through in big divisional games, and that was important because
there's
the best
no question.
Way to win your division and make the playoffs is to do that against the Cowboys, Washington, and Philadelphia. So that's why I bring up the red zone production, because more often than not, he found the end zone against those three division rivals. Now, if Kenny Golladay could do that, you know, that's a huge step in the right direction. Now, whether or not Golladay is as big of a threat with Yak as Plaxico, I think that remains to be seen. I think we've seen flashes of that with Detroit.
Yeah.
So I think he's capable, if you could get him out into open space, that he could do some damage after the catch. But I think what really jumps out is he's going to try to win and put the quarterback in a position where if you give him a chance, he'll make a play for the QB.
And
that,
know,
to me, is important.
A guy who we've kind of slighted here, and it's our fault for not mentioning his name, is Kyle Rudolph, who, by the way, is not the biggest, tallest, longest wingspan that you're going to find in the NFL. But my goodness, Lance, if you get the ball within his frame, he's catching it. He's got really soft hands, and if the ball is going to be on his body, the defensive back's not getting it. He shields extremely well and is very reliable as a pass catcher on the other end of that pass.
Well, you look at the fact that Rudolph is 6'6", Evan Engram is 6'3", And we haven't even talked about the wide receivers. So you already have height at the tight end position. I remember Rudolph was the one that caught that game-winning touchdown against the Saints in the playoffs not too long ago when they threw it left corner of the end zone as Kirk Cousins found Kyle Rudolph. So he's been well-documented as a player that's going to also win those 50-50 balls. And I think the more area of the field that you need to force the defense to wonder, do we double-team this guy because we don't necessarily have a great defender that can handle him one-on-one? That's how you improve your red zone efficiency because you don't have to rely on one guy to win those jump balls. You have multiple options. And I think between Galladay, Evan Engram, and Kyle Rudolph, at least on paper, from just pure size, okay, let's put the production to the side. From just the paper, the size, the elements that you're working with, that at least is encouraging for Daniel Jones entering this season.
And you know, now that I'm looking at the numbers, Lance, see, I've never thought, even though Rudolph is a big guy, I've never thought of him as having long arms or a wide wingspan. Maybe that's just because of the way he plays and he does it so effortlessly. I'm just looking now at the wingspan, Evan Engram at 79.1, and believe it or not, wingspan for Kyle Rudolph is even longer than that. It's 80. Kyle Rudolph has a wider wingspan, 80.3. I'm surprised. To be perfectly honest with you, I am surprised that he has a longer or wider wingspan than Kyle Rudolph does. I mean Rudolph over Engram. I did not expect that when I'm looking at the numbers right here, because it just doesn't seem that way. And maybe that's because Rudolph does such a good job of shielding with his body that he doesn't have to make those reaching catches.
And I think that's part of it. I also think Kyle Rudolph is not known as a flashy player, so maybe he doesn't
not at
get
all.
Credit. For his measurements compared to maybe Evan Engram, who can dazzle you a little bit more in the open field, especially after the catch. Rudolph's not the type of guy that's going to take off and gain 20 yards after the catch. So I think that's probably why he doesn't get credit for that. But the other thing that I'll point out about Kyle Rudolph, and I thought this was a really great parallel that he brought up when he had his press conference with the media, he compared himself to a basketball player because he has a basketball background, and he said, I view my red zone production or how I go about my business very similar to when I was playing basketball going after a rebound and a loose ball. Just being in the proper position to get vertical to win the battle with the individual that I was trying to beat. So I thought that was interesting because you could look at how he's gone about his business in the red zone and you could see, hey, it's very similar to trying to box out, go up, grab the loose ball. He's got a very similar approach from that standpoint.
Well, quite frankly, physically, and it's no surprise, you know, you remember when Red Ellison was with the Vikings and he was there when Rudolph wound up becoming the lead guy and then Ellison eventually came to the Giants. Now Rudolph is following the same path. Very similar kind of guys, right? Ellison was about 6'5", 255, 260. He was right in that ballpark. Similar measurements, but did not have the pass receiving skills that Rudolph has. I mean, there's no question. Ellison was much more regarded as a blocker. Even used him as fullback for Peterson a lot of times when Peterson ran for the 2,000 yards that one year. He was not regarded as much of a pass catcher. Rudolph clearly has been throughout his entire NFL career. I just think, you know, they're fortunate to get him. I hope the foot thing has been taken care of. They seem to believe that it will be and that he's going to be a go for training camp. Obviously, that's something the Giants have to keep an eye on. But again, let's not forget the fact that he's another guy who, if you can get the ball where it's supposed to be, he'll make a play for you. He's not going to leave plays out on the field. I think maybe that's the best phrase here that we could use for guys like Galladay and guys like Rudolph. They won't leave plays empty out on the field. They will finish plays, and that's got to help the quarterback.
All right, that's going to wrap up things for us here on Monday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live. We thank to our two guests who joined us to break down Virginia Tech as well as Kentucky. We'll continue to preview a few more schools as we lead up to the NFL draft. Big Blue Kickoff Live is part of the Giants Podcast Network. It was brought to you by Investors Bank on the Giants mobile app, podcast platforms everywhere, and at giants.com/podcast. For Paul Dottino, I'm Lance Meadows. Stay locked to giants.com for all the latest. We'll be back up and running with Tuesday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live tomorrow at noon Eastern. Have a good one, everybody.
Really quickly, just a reminder, tomorrow's show, we have that press conference with Dave Gettleman and Kevin Abrams, which comes your way at 12:30. Big Blue Kickoff Live will be on after that at 1. Just FYI, programming note.
So there you go. As we inch closer to the draft, we'll be hearing from executives from the Giants front office. So note the different start time tomorrow following the press conference as the Giants will address the media. For Paul DeTino, I'm Lance Medow. We'll speak to you tomorrow. Have a good one.